Welcome to Unpacking Peanuts, the podcast where three cartoonists take an in-depth look at the greatest comic strip of all time, Peanuts by Charles M. Schulz.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. This is Unpacking Peanuts, and we have such good news for you today. We have a very, very special guest in the studio. But before we introduce him, I just want to say hello too. Hi, it's me, Jimmy Gownley. I'm your host for this evening. I'm also the cartoonist of Amelia Rules, Seven Good Reasons Not to Grow Up, and The Dumbest Idea Ever. Joining me, as always, are my pals, co-hosts, and fellow cartoonists. He's a playwright. He's a composer, both for the band Complicated People, as well as for this very podcast. He's the co-creator of the original comic book Price Guide, the original editor for Amelia Rules, and the creator of such great strips as Strange Attractors, A Gathering of Spells, and Tangled River. It's Michael Cohen.
Hey there.
And he's the executive producer and writer of Mystery Science Theater 3000. He's a former vice president of Archie Comics and the current creator of the Instagram sensation Sweetest Beasts. It's Harold Buchholz.
Hello.
I am so happy to let you guys out there in Unpacking Peanuts land know that today we have a very, very special guest. It is Joel Hodgson. Joel is the creative genius behind the cult sci-fi comedy series Mystery Science Theater 3000. Two recent critically acclaimed series are on Netflix, and the newest 13-episode season can be found online directly at gizmoplex.com. I imagine if you're listening to this podcast, you're at least vaguely familiar with Mystery Science Theater. But if not, the show is based around the idea of cheesy genre films ranging from old monster movies to low budget sword and sandal and Mexican wrestling films. In the show, these movies are comically commented on are riffed throughout by three unwilling test subjects, one host and two robot friends on a satellite in outer space. That's Mystery Science Theater 3000. But you already know that because you're hip. And that's why you're also listening to this podcast. Anyway, please welcome to Unpacking Peanuts, Mr. Joel Hodgson. Now, did you ever think you might want to be a professional cartoonist?
Absolutely.
Was that something? Yeah.
I used to play cartoonist with my sister, and we'd sit on the couch. I'd sit on one side of the couch and she'd sit on the other side of the couch. And she'd get an imaginary phone call. Ring. Hello, Joel Hodgson, cartoonist. What do you need? What's that? You need a drawing of a duck? She goes, they think they need a drawing of a duck. Can you do a duck? And I go, let me think about that. Yeah, tell him I can do a duck. She goes, he'll do the duck.
Oh, man. That's just how it is for a professional cartoonist, right, Jimmy?
I'd draw a duck and I'd hand it to her, and then she'd get another phone call.
It just kept rolling in.
For another character. It was really fun, though, but that's what I thought professional.
Now, would you have thought, would it have been like a daily strip that you would have wanted to do, like Peanuts, or would you would have
wanted to do a comic book? It was simply
Preston Blair style. Yeah.
Drawings. An animal. This is when I was like in first grade, so I didn't know about the Preston Blair book, but it was like, I don't think I had a notion of, like, in my mind, a cartoon was like an animated cartoon. I didn't really associate cartoons with print for a long, long time, I think. It was mostly when I wanted to draw cartoons, it's because I wanted them to move, and I didn't really understand, you know, the flatness and the art of comics, you know, and the way it works, you know. I think that's something I think most of the stuff is from that Scott McCloud book, right, Harold? Like the stuff that I got or learned about comics, that was just like an epiphany to find that book because I didn't understand.
That's so cool to hear that, you know, you engaging with that book all of a sudden kind of opened up that world to you. I think that's the genius of Scott McCloud.
I think it's a brilliant book that is it's incredible. It's really incredible.
I think it's funny because now that 30 years have gone since that book came out, and people nitpick various parts of his arguments as if, they can sort of get one over on him. But
he's 7 years old. Like, he came up with it when he was seven.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's brilliant. It's, you know, the very thought that I'm going to explain comics using a comic is so simple and so genius.
Great. It's so great. You know? And I think I had read that. I think I had read that before coming out to when I was in Los Angeles and thinking it was just so wonderful and saying to myself, I'd love to do a comic someday and feel like I understood it well enough to for it to register and for it to be.
And that's how we first met. Was I was working at Archie Comics and I came to your Cinematic Titanic show at the, I think it was the New Jersey Performing Arts Center in Trenton, or Newark. It was in Newark. And we, I gave you my card and the next day you called me and I said, hey, you want to do a comic book? And you were like, hey, let's talk. And that was the start of our relationship.
So I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar with Mystery Science Theater 3000. You guys know that, right? It's been part of the pop culture landscape for, over 30 years now, and has had so many iterations from the early days, starting out in just Minnesota through Comedy Central, and now streaming on Netflix and beyond. It's on Gizmodo.com now. At this part, Harold and Joel talk a little bit about that journey.
Yeah, comics, agreed. And I think I really relied on you a lot when we were going into the comic, because I think one of the first things that was a problem was I thought, done deal, man. We just put a silhouette at the bottom of every frame.
Just like the TV show.
And have the funny stuff. And I didn't really recall that notion that the eye starts at the top left corner and arrives at the bottom right corner. So essentially, because Crow's at the bottom right, the thing that only makes sense is for him to deliver the line. It's the only thing there's kind of space for. It's just that thing. And once I figured that out and understood that, then we had to kind of go back and start all over.
Yeah, I mean, my recollection on that, go ahead.
Hang on, let's back up a little bit. First, explain your relationship to each other to begin with. Harold, what did you do for Mystery Science Theater?
Oh, sure.
Once
well, let me tell
at,
you.
On the show.
Let me tell you.
Oh, you're
Harold really helped me. Here's how Harold helped me, and I think it's very simple, but a big job, which was he really encouraged me and appeared knowledgeable enough to be able to help me with what I wanted to do. And so we spent really a lot of time. I want to say it's 1,000 hours.
Yeah.
That's kind of where I was kind of comfortable with it. Just talking and sorting it all out. Because I think a lot of it is I had a lot of baggage from Mystery Science Theater. I mean, I think that was part of it back then, right? Wasn't I think still
even
like
our first, or even our first conversation, you were processing a lot of things and you were like, you were working on Cinematic Titanic and we're wanting to get the rights back to Mystery Science Theater. I think you told me that first time we met that you saw that was your legacy and you weren't done with it and you wanted another chance at it. And I was like, I was a huge fan of the show. Diane Cook, my wife and I were huge fans. And so it's like, well, what can I do to help? How can we get there? And that was the beginning of our friendship.
Yeah. And Harold was available and we really, really just spent a lot of time talking. So I think number one, he let me complain. He was very gracious to let me complain really a lot until I was exhausted of complaining. And then after that, we could kind of get to work. And then it was really sorting out the legal stuff and how to approach it and how to frame it, you know, and how to start, which is not easy to do when you're starting over with, I don't know what you call it, a property. You're starting with revisiting a property that a lot of people like and a lot of people know. And how do you match that in a way that's authentic and honest, right? That's you really who we are now rather than, it's a love letter to the Halcyon days of Mystery Science Yore, you know?
Right. And that would be so depressing as a fan, right?
Oh yeah. But people think that's what it should be. You know, that's kind of that was kind of an idea. And it was also trying to escape the Joel Mike thing was still so big. And it was I was so interested in kind of putting that to sleep, kind of like the easy way to do this is just get a new person in there and everyone will understand it's not Joel and Mike, it's Joel and Mike and the next person and the next person, right? Mm-hmm. So that kind of took care of that. But those were really big things that people seemed very, had really strong opinions about. Yeah. You could feel it. It was palpable. It was palpable that people didn't think it had to be either Joel or Mike, or what version of Joel or Mike is it going to be? And when I said, it's not going to be me, it's somebody else, then it kind of, that was a little bit, we had to really lean into that and feel comfortable and confident about that. So that took a lot of time and a lot of thinking.
Yeah. And for the people listening who may not be as familiar with Mystery Science Theater, so the show began in 1988 as a UHF show in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, which is where Charles Schulz hails from. And it quickly became a big deal in locally, and then you guys sent it off to, was it a comedy channel, and they wound up buying it, and you were hosting this show. So the show is this, how do you describe the show, Joel?
Well, I usually ask if you have a piece of paper and I draw it. I draw the I draw the silhouettes, and then I draw a monster. I draw people on filling the rest of the frame, and I go, does this look familiar? And if they go, yeah, I go, well, that's what I do. And if they don't know, then I go, well, it's basically a show that involves running a movie and then people kind of remarking as it goes along. It's called movie riffing. And if they don't understand at that point, then I just put it away and go, it's on that.
You were the original host of that show. So you and two robot characters that in the story you built, right?
Well, I think too, the other thing is I was the creator of it, and I had a career. The important part is I had a career prior. And I was a comedian on national television on SNL and Letterman and Young Comedian Special. So I was kind of teed up to get to do a show, and Mystery Science Theater was the show I chose to do. And I chose to do it in Minneapolis on UHF to kind of, get it going and grow it, So
like a proof of concept.
But anyway, then it was on Comedy Channel and had a nice long life on cable for 11 years. So,
yeah.
So then it was fallow for another 10 or 12 years or something. But it did great on DVDs and
huge fan base,
VHSs and stuff. And then when, the internet started, all that stuff, streaming, et cetera.
Yeah. And so regarding the Mike and Joel thing. So you basically half of those years you were on cable, you hosted, and then you left the show, and then Mike Nelson hosted the show for last half.
That's correct. Exactly. And so anyway, we tend to neglect to mention that it's a comedy show, but it is.
Is it a comedy show?
Right. And then, I'm happy to reiterate it to people. And it's a puppet show. It has, hosts, and it has these robots, companions that are kind of puppet friends that watch the movie with this guy, and that's kind of that's the show. And so it doesn't sound that good when you explain it. And
I love Mystery Science Theater. I think I could pitch it better than that.
You know what? You'd be willing to say some things that I wouldn't say, which
right,
would just kind of
like brilliant, like I didn't hilarious. Use,
oh, it's hilarious, and it'll make you laugh. I can't.
Here's what I would say. I would say it is going to give you new language for your day to day life.
Well, that's
meaning there are some jokes in your show that are so funny and so right on that they are now just things I say. This also happens with Peanuts all the time. The one that I say all the time is, and I don't even know if you'll remember it, it's, boy, the glow of the essay contest is really starting to fade. Do you remember that at all?
I don't. That's hilarious.
It is from the best episode, which is I accuse my parents.
Love that one.
Oh yeah, we just screened that in the Gizmoplex. That's I like that one a lot too. One of my favorites. Yeah.
Yeah, it starts off this kid wins an essay contest, and then his life, because his parents are basically insane, just gets worse and worse and worse. Till at the end, I think he's like robbing a guy at gunpoint or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah. Tough life.
At one point, one of the robots says, "This boy, the glow of the essay contest is really starting to fade."
I love it.
That's great.
Well,
so just to finish out the our relationship. So basically, like you said, we spent like 1,200 hours just thinking, how do we get to this place? Because you kind of had the vision from the very first day I met you. We had a long lunch, and you basically said, I want a small little studio in Pennsylvania with a kind of my own dream team of people that I can train up the way I want to and what I'm doing to make the show that I want. And at the end of the day, and I was saying, hey, you need to crowdfund this thing because there's so much pent up love for you and the show. And if you said, I want another chance at it, boy, people are just going to come out of the woodwork to support that. And they did. I mean, that wound up kind of as the culmination of our, relationship. While I was still working at Archie Comics and just kind of helping Joel on the side, it did culminate that he worked with Shout Factory, who had put out the DVDs, and together they kind of purchased Mystery Science Theater from its owner and wound up gearing up to make a new season. And that's when, Joel, at some point, I think he said, if this happens, I want you to run my company. And that was a huge honor for me to do that, and for you to invite me into your process and your creative process when I started working with you. I think we were together about 3.5 years, actually physically working on the television show and the live tours and all of that was an amazing small group of people out of Pennsylvania, Cheryl Volpe and Seth Robinson and Matt McGinnis. It was just an amazing thing for me to come into your process of how you wanted to create a show, how you approached comedy. And frankly, that one of the last things we did together was that comic book. I mean, it's so funny. We started with that conversation, but that kind of ended the time I was running the company as president of Alterniversal.
Yeah, that's right. And it's really interesting. And I think there was a moment that I especially remember. What we did in the comic was fairly complex because we were basically repurposing old comic books, and we wanted to do it, in an elegant way. And the great thing is Mystery Science Theater is a science fiction show, and it's easy to kind of create conceits in science fiction that you can't have normally. So we were able to kind of figure that out very practically and really approach it with an open mind, because my first premise was not functioning, wasn't going to function. Remember, we did those tests with Randy Stradley, where we put the silhouettes on every frame and it's
just like in the show.
It wrecks the entire experience. It wrecks. Yeah. There is no stylish way to do that. It like puts a, it's like putting a UPC symbol on every frame of a comic, right? doesn't do nothing for you. And so once we got to that side, then it was like, well, how is this going to work? And so that became a job to kind of solve that creatively within the universe of the show and then translate that to the comic language. And so Harold was really great about that and helping us understand that. And even for me to communicate with our artists and stuff, Harold understood that vernacular of drawing and printing processes, because we had to match printing processes, because we'd make fake, I guess they'd be what you would call them, artifacts. We'd make fake artifacts of comics that had our characters in them and needed to look like they were in those comics originally. So that meant communicating that. And I was, I could kind of point to things, but having Harold there to intercede and kind of reiterate these processes, like printing, like how would you describe what we're trying to replicate from a printing point of view, Harold. Well, how would you describe that?
Right. So we were taking old public domain comics, and they range from, we had a, if anybody's familiar with old Golden Age comics, we had a Black Cat comic, which was a female superhero really early on in the early 40s that Harvey Comics put out. And that was selected as one of the comics we would enter the characters into. Because like when we're doing Mystery Science Theater, the TV show, they are silhouettes of people in a movie theater watching this film. But in this world, you know, Joel quickly came to the conclusion that these characters, our characters can enter the world. We can do that. It's technically possible. So why don't we have our characters become a part of this old comics? So there was a 1940s Black Cat superhero comic. There was a 1950s pre-code horror comic called Horrific that we took some stories from, that Crow the Robot went into as the Crow Keeper, kind of like the old EC horror comics. And then there was a very early 1960s comic from Dell, which was kind of the more wholesome kiddie comics, but it was a Johnny Jason teen reporter comic, which was just classic. And so Tom Servo, the other robot character that's featured heavily in the show, he becomes basically Tom Servo teen reporter. And so he replaces the main character in that comic. And so we were working with amazing artists like Todd Nock and Mike Manley. And I apologize, I'm not going to mention all the amazing people who worked on this, but it was, we had to make it look like these old these faded comic books from, with really bad printing processes, and we're getting scans of old printed newsprint comics in this rough color, and asking the artists to rough up their own artwork so it looks like it fits in that world. And they did an absolutely amazing job. I mean, we asked so much of Dark Horse to make this a really special comic, and it was not the assembly line process of, you know, writer writes, sends it off to the penciler who sends it to the inker, and then the letterer, and nobody communicates with each other. This was a really collaborative process, and Joel, you were getting back pages, and we were making comments, and we were changing jokes, and it was amazing to me that Dark Horse just dove in with us, and these amazing artists really knocked themselves out to match the style. You were putting Totino's pizza roll ads that the mad scientist who's putting this book together, she's constantly trying to insert advertisements into the comic book. And so we had to have extended sequences where, say, the Johnny Jason and Tom Servo teen reporter story, which we were following panel by panel and page by page as it had been printed, all of a sudden we needed two new pages that didn't exist at all for this Totino's joke. And so artists like Mike Manley had to match the artwork of this 1960s style. And it was a tall order. And these artists really stood up to that.
Jack Pollock, too, I wanted to mention.
Yes, Jack Pollock.
You had Jackson Pollock?
Yeah, it was a little messy, but...
I got to say, that's a flex.
Of a lot of knots, and it ran into a Roy Lichtenstein joke along the way.
But, yeah. Listen, we're gonna have to take a break, and then we'll come back and talk about some Peanut stuff, but this is a great opportunity for me to throw something out here that I want to get on the record. So... before Harold worked for you, Joel, and before he worked for Archie Comics, he worked for me and Michael, actually, in our publishing company that put out Amelia Rules.
Yeah.
And we were basically dead in the water. So I would just like to say to any of the fans out there who are listening who like any of this stuff, if you like my Amelia Rules comics, especially the second half, if you like Archie Comics still existing, and if you like the fact that there's new Mystery Science Theater, thank Harold Buchholz, because he was a part of all of that. Wouldn't happen without him.
I think we should call this Unpacking Harold.
Absolutely. Well, and then here's the other thing I want to say before my break. You said you used to whine to Harold. I'm more of a yeller than a whiner. Oh. And this is my impression of Harold, the one time I got him furious. Okay, this is Harold Buchholz furious. Well, what would you like me to do, Jim? And I was like, whoa!
Take it down. That is icy. I see. When you get that from Harold, like, Yeah. Can you imagine
him? You don't bounce back.
Like, really mad at you. That would just like ruin my day.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I don't know if I'd come back from that.
In many ways, I didn't. But we will come back right after this break, and we'll talk more with a legend, someone Jerry Seinfeld called a cultural visionary, Joel Hodgson. We'll be right back.
Hey, this is Joel Hodgson, the creator of Mystery Science Theater, and you're listening to Unpacking Peanuts.
And we're back, and now we're talking with Joel Hodgson about his early days before MST3K.
Yeah, basically, you were in L.A. doing comedy, and was there the temptation to get on a staff of writing sitcoms?
I was very interested in it, but there weren't any at that time. There weren't any sitcoms that I thought were funny. I really would have only really wanted to write on Letterman if that back then. That was kind of a very, I just loved that show, and unfortunately at that time SNL wasn't doing that good, and so it was kind of the you know, I can't quite remember. Maybe it was like, you know, Dick Ebersol, Eddie Murphy was on his way out, kind of, I guess, is the way I remember it, kind of era of SNL. So it wasn't, SNL wasn't really the SNL that the first 5 years was like. And so I didn't see any sitcoms on the periphery that I thought were funny. They were all kind of big Leviathan shows. And I did read for the part of Woody, though.
Did you?
On Cheers. Yeah. Like, I remember going into Paramount and doing a reading on the Cheers set, and it was the Woody part. So I don't know if his name was Woody then. I think they might have popped it at Woody because his name was Woody Harrelson. Right. But it was, I read for that part. But even then, I didn't think Cheers was that great. And now I really like it, but, you know, I just don't think comics in their 20s are usually interested in sitcoms, you know, and or at least good ones.
You were offered a part, weren't you?
Yeah. I got invited to do, I was friends with Gary Shandling, and Shandling introduced.
Yeah.
That's the great comedy of this. Of that.
Oh, yeah. He introduced me to, his manager, Brad Gray, and I got signed by Brad Gray, and we got offers for stuff. And High School USA, I read for that, and I got the part as one of, you know, comic relief on High School USA, which was a Michael J. Fox sitcom. And so it was on, it was a guarantee, you know, six on the air guaranteed kind of deal. And I just didn't think it was funny. And I'm really not an actor, you know? So I was like, I had a comic persona that I could do, but if anything outside of that, I didn't feel very comfortable.
Well, you were in Freaks and Geeks. What was that like to actually?
Well, that was long after.
Well, that's right.
Theater.
Right.
This is when I'm like, I'm
so that's a different.
And that's, I was probably 32 or older when I did Freaks and Geeks. But yeah, at that time it was just, I didn't want to do it. And I thought it would hurt my career if I got involved with a project that wasn't funny. A lot of people don't think like that, but I do. And I feel like if I have a fan base that likes what I do and they see me do something that's not good, I'll probably lose them. So when I passed on it, they had me meet with Brandon Tartikoff, who was the head of the network at the time. And
NBC.
He just talked to me, and he was a very sweet man and really, really was fair with me and just kind of was really wanted to curiously know why I didn't want to do it. And I didn't have the heart to tell him I didn't think it was funny. I just kind of found other excuses, but I just didn't think I'd come out of it looking good. So that was kind of my reasoning for not doing
it. So to step back, so you were born in Wisconsin and raised in Wisconsin, went to college at Bethel College in the Minneapolis St. Paul area, and started doing, from childhood, I guess you were doing magic, you were doing stand up prop comedy. You told me your senior year in college, how many different gigs did you do outside of the university?
I have it in a, I had a day planner, and I figured out how many shows I did that senior year, and it was in the hundreds.
Oh my God.
It's just mind boggling that you were finishing out your senior year at college and you already were that active outside of the school performing. I mean, and that led into stand up, which then took you out to LA as you were describing. And then you came to this moment where you had to decide, you know, what the next step was after you'd gotten on Saturday Night Live, you'd gotten on Letterman.
I got everything I wanted to do. I got on the Young Comedian Special and on SNL and on Letterman. And I didn't feel like, I guess one other option I could have played was maybe try to get my own one man. Those were kind of falling out of fashion, like the one man, like Gallagher specials. Yes. Like I would do Gallagher specials, and they were kind of, for some reason, it escaped me. I would have really liked to have done that.
Now, you wrote and performed in Jerry Seinfeld's very first comedy
Stand
special.
Stand Up Confidential, yep, right? I love that's that. Right. I think that's hilarious.
Thanks, man. Yeah, it was that was a wonderful experience. And a lot of that experience with Seinfeld really helped tee up MST. Do you want me to tell that story about Seinfeld?
Yeah, absolutely I do.
Yeah, please.
Okay, well, I was really lucky because my act was really unique. And because of that, I think I've noticed this as I've gotten older, but you can pick out certain people that don't need you. They're very autonomous and they are moving and you know they're going to occupy that space whether you're there or not. And when you see those people, you immediately want to be friends with them because they don't need anything from you. And I think I was like that for those guys. So because of that, I'd meet great comics and they liked me and they'd have me open for them because my act was so unique. And guys like that were guys like Shandling and Jerry Seinfeld. And both these guys really, really helped me out and really, really kind of mentored me in really unique ways. I knew Seinfeld from LA and I'd see him in the improv and I'd see him at the Comedy Magic Club and he always was a nice guy. We didn't hang out in LA at all, but when he came to Minneapolis, this is after I had quit, I came to watch him do a set. And I found that was a unique environment because when a guy's on the road, there's not a lot of distractions, so we could hang out. And after his set, it was at the Comedy Gallery, which was owned by Scott Hansen in Minneapolis. And after the gig, I just started to describe to him what he was making me see, what images I was imagining. And he said, you know what? I just got asked to do my first HBO special and I'd like you to help me write it. And I said, that's awesome. And so it was really cool. He'd come to Minneapolis for a week and I'd go to LA for a week and we worked on it. And at the end of it, yeah, we had Stand Up Confidential, which really is the majority of Jerry's stand up. And then the kind of conceptual webbing of his narrative and the production that went with it was the stuff that we came up with. But he was very great.
It's so cool because it really is a weird and fun blend of your two sensibilities. You seem to be getting him to do things that are like sillier and more conceptual than his normal observational stuff, like the X-ray specs. Yeah. It's great. It's so fun. The dog costumes.
Well, what's really interesting is that's the way he really is. Uh-huh. But he's such a good comic that he'll take those ideas and just blend them into this beautiful like tone poem of stand-up that's hilarious. But all his ideas kind of start that way, and that's what's really fun about him. And of course, it's the, you know, we think of him as the button down, you know, fantastic stand-up, which he is, but all those ideas start very like are very colorful, I think, when he first talks about them. And so, yeah, I was super grateful for that experience because I was really sick of thinking about my own stuff. And it felt really good to just kind of focus on somebody else and try to amplify their message and amplify their thoughts and their what they wanted. It was really good for me to just kind of get to do that. And so after that, I started to work on a treatment for him, which is a science fiction movie. And it was, I can't really recall too much about it other than I designed this set and he was like in it and floating. And I think he goes to a planet where it's like Gulliver's Travels, but I think it's a world, it's a society of children. Right. And he's the only adult there. And so that's all as far as I got with it. And he looks at me and he goes, "You know what? This isn't a show for me. This is a show for you." And at that moment, it was like that gestalt moment where you go, you know, he's absolutely right. Like I want to do this, but I don't want to be the guy on camera. I want him to be the guy on camera. And so, right. And so then I started to change the way I was thinking. And I had this idea in my back pocket that was Mystery Science Theater, which was the silhouettes with public domain content, you know, and robot puppets, right? So that was kind of that premise. And so that really got me, he just called me on it. He goes, "Well, are you trying to make me do, you know," the subtext is, "You want this to happen, do right. it. You know what I mean? You want a science fiction movie, you do it. It's obviously not me." And when you think about him saying that, it's true. Like you were saying, we don't think of him that way with that in that kind of colorful world, though he could occupy it and be really great. But he's more buttoned down, you know, it's more a different character. But when he says that to you, it's very liberating. And you realize, yeah, I'm barking up the wrong tree trying to get him to do this. So, yeah.
All right. So listen, we are going to now, we've selected four Peanuts comic strips to talk about with the great Joel Hodgson. And we're going to start with a classic. It's the very first one, October 2nd, 1950. Take it away, Joel.
Well, here comes old Charlie Brown. Good old Charlie Brown. Yes, sir. Good old Charlie Brown. How I hate him.
Hey, woo!
So this one, I think I have read the book, the biography, the recent biography of Charles Schulz. What was it called?
Schulz and Peanuts.
Yeah, Schulz and Peanuts. And so I do know a little bit about the backstory about this, but it's the first one that comes to mind, and it's just so radical in my mind, and it's so indicative of, the kind of like Schulz's thinking. But I'm curious what you guys think about this.
Well, radical is the word for it, I think.
Yeah. How is it radical to you, Joel? I mean, what makes it stand out? Like when you're looking at the newspaper strips, you know, when you're growing up and you see something like this, what is it that makes that so different than everything else?
Well, it's kind of, I think we've talked about this with Peanuts is it's very adult. And the way the kid's ruminating, he's repeating himself, is not like what kids do.
Right.
You know, there's some Schadenfreude in there, I guess, and repeating it and kind of running it in his mouth a few times, right? And then, oh, how I hate him. And so I think that was, again, I feel like so, you know, naive about this because I have this limited understanding of comics. But, you know, I feel like I'm saying this to you and you guys have discussed this probably thoroughly, but they're just, very adult. Like that's adorable. Mm-hmm. Kids who talk like adults, you can't beat it. Right. And that's what he did so well.
And now everybody can kind of use that right? The kids talking as adults thing is now just a starting point for everybody, like Calvin and Hobbes or anything else. But at this point,
yes.
It's hard to even realize how radical this stuff was, I think.
Yes. Yes. And it did something for everyone.
Yeah.
It did something for adults because they could, it's adorable because it's imposing all these sophisticated ideas. And as kids, we felt really bright, like being able to follow along. Yeah. Like it was edifying for kids as well. So you kind of met in the middle, like for, you know, it's very like, it's real crazy when there's something in pop culture that is, I want to use a word that is like, I want to be really, I don't want to say it's edifying, but wholesome. Mm-hmm. And I mean that in the best way, wholesome being like a whole, something a whole person can appreciate and negotiate. So wholesome.
Yeah.
It's this thing where, parents, like I, it was one of the few things in the world for me that it seemed like everyone approved of. Everyone approved of it. And there's something really, really crazy great about that, that you don't get in many other things. Right.
Yeah. You saying that gives me goosebumps. I have a theory, Joel. I wanted to bounce this off of you. I mean, you grew up, like I said, in Wisconsin and then in Minnesota and your young adulthood. And then you kind of went out into the world and you saw the world and then you chose to come back to where you'd gone to school. And I had this theory that there are a lot of people who leave their hometowns and regions for entertainment hubs like New York or LA. And a lot of those people are leaving their families and their roots for a reason. And often those are the people who have the reason to get away from where they grew up. They've got reasons. And as a result, it seems like there's a lot of comedy that comes out of New York and LA that kind of rejects their roots, right? Mm-hmm. It's not always the case, but that seems common. And I'm thinking about you and Charles Schulz, where, you know, he never seemed to reject those roots. He seemed to be kind of comfortable with where he came from, even though he wound up moving out to California just 8 years into the Strip. But there's a lot of who he was and how he grew up, and obviously lots of his memories, including painful memories, that he's bringing from. There is this continuity for him. He's not starting over and starting fresh like I think a lot of people try to do. And I get that sense from your work as well, that it's kind of grounded in memories that go back to childhood. And some of those are fond memories. I mean, you've told me stories about, you know, you were performing in your local church and they were very supportive of you when you're doing magic tricks and stuff. And they the people in that church were supporting you. And I don't think everybody has that experience, but my theory is that the people that did have those kinds of whatever they had to go through in their childhoods, they never found reason to reject it and oppose it and leave it. It's still a part of them. And I see that in your work and I see that in Schulz's work. And I think it comes around to that concept of wholesome in the sense that it's like the wholeness of who you are and how you've grown up. It stays as a piece through your creative
Well, life. Thanks. Thanks, man. Well, I think that it's funny, but there is this kind of obligation, I think, that you have when you are in that environment or you're in the church. There's this environment to be considerate of everyone who's in the audience, right? And so if you start segmenting out the audience, you have to have really good jokes to do that. You have to explain why you're segmenting someone out, you know? And so I guess there's just this, I feel like maybe there's this obligation there that says, well, we're not really having fun unless everyone can be in on it. Right. Mm-hmm. And if it was isolated or segmented or had more restrictions or was more adult or whatever, because there are things in MST that are way more adult, naughty than Peanuts ever got. But I think we treat it like we kind of say it's all veiled, hopefully. and there is a, you know, we kind of just say it's PG-14. We assume that you're either with an adult who's who can guide you through this, or you're 14 or older to watch this. So
that's a Seinfeld thing too. Yeah. The idea of taking things that are more adult and complex and repackaging it, rephrasing it in a way that you could watch with your kid. Mm.
Yeah, man. He's very alert to that too. I really got a lot. He grew up in a really joyous like situation. His dad and mom got along great, and they were funny, and his dad was funny, and so he just kind of was around it, and he was encouraged, you know, interpersonally. So I think that's true. There's just a piece. I mean, to be honest, it was just a fabric of my life because my dad was like an entertainer. He was just completely an amateur entertainer and would do all kinds of things to amuse people. And I just grew up with my dad building things and putting on building costumes. It is just in his heart, you know? And so I grew up.
Who would his audiences be, Joel? Like where would he get a chance?
It would always be stuff at church or school. Cause he was a teacher.
Mm-hmm. What did he teach?
He's a science teacher.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And so he was always doing things that I guess I always suspected they were a little out of the ordinary, and just, it made me kind of track that kind of person and pay attention to that kind of person in the world. And my dad was that guy. My dad was like, I'll give you one example. Like we went over to the Forsbergs' house and they were friends from our church, and they would have these really fun, spirited parties. And my dad would disappear and he'd come out of the bedroom dressed in drag as Mrs. Santa Claus. And he'd walk through the party and he'd get the guys to sit on his knee and like, what do you want from Mrs. Santa? And it's like, and he didn't tell, I didn't really understand this was going to happen, but the way people reacted, it made people so happy. And it was like, they would just like had this like twinkle in their eye. Cause my dad did this silly, crazy thing and he could pull it off and make it funny and make everybody glad that he did it rather than challenge alone and afraid that he did. So he had this way, and people like really loved him for it. And so I kind of grew up around that. But again, it's easier to see now that I'm older, and I'm like, when I look in the mirror, I go, oh, I look like my dad now. And so it makes me think of him more often, you know?
That's funny. Cause you told the story of when you were at Bethel College that you kind of got your start in public speaking there at just like reading the, was it like reading the notes or something, or the,
yeah, kind
of, what was that all about?
It's funny that like Bethel College is a Christian college. It's a Baptist college. And they had chapel every day. It was in the gymnasium, and they had these kids that were from the speech department and the communications department. And I was a communication major, so I was kind of tracking them. And they got up and they were really well-groomed. And they had they're just dressed really smartly. And they spoke like news anchors. Like they spoke like like professional news anchors. They smiled, they paused. They had, you know, they just had all this verve in their voice. And I'm sitting there going, wow, I think I can make this funny. I think I could do this. And so I got in doing announcements. For whatever reason, I just did it poorly.
For whatever reason?
I just did it poorly. Like I couldn't sound out certain words, and I'd get the punctuation wrong and read into the next announcement, and people really laughed at it. People really, I was getting well known because I would come up and people wanted me to do their announcements because they were memorable, you know. And so
are you saying that this was 100% intentional or 80% intentional? Or
when well, I knew that something
for the comedy.
There's a risk because I'm not like I wasn't calculated enough to know that it would work, but I had a feeling that mm-hmm. it could.
So you kind of lean into
So it was kind of like I could have bailed and said, "Hey, I'm just a communication major like everyone else, and I just need practice," you know. Or if I could have got it to work. For whatever reason, it was that spirit of just I wanted to create a little mischief because they were kind of being assholes, you know. I felt they're kind of like being a little. It felt like they were patronizing. That's what it felt like, and I think that
the other readers, you mean?
Yeah, they were patronizing. They were treating us like we weren't college kids, like we were like watching news or something. There was some beats missing that I felt like there was something that kind of frustrated me about it and said, I think I can do this and I can get this to work and be better. It can function better if I did this a different way. It'll be more fun, more memorable, and I'll get the message across if I can do this.
And by your senior year, you have graduated into performing a ton. But that was kind of the beginning of your really, adult?
Yeah, it was kind of like, I think it's making people your own age laugh. Like, I think that's like a really important part of it too, you know, there's people that go, "I'm great at making old people laugh. Hardy har har." And you just go, "Well, okay, that's awesome. That's waiting for all of us when we're old. But what about now?" You know what I mean? And so, so it was kind of like, I think that was important, and it's kind of like my peers and trying to understand how to make them laugh. And I think that's what happens to all of us who get creative is we have people spark to what we do, right? They just like, we all have those moments. Like if we're talking about Charles Schulz, like real true social currency was being able to draw Snoopy.
Right.
Like if you could do that, man, things would start happening for you in grade school, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, hey, do you want to check out the next strip and we can kind of keep?
Sure. I'm going to jump ahead here. The other one that really, really registered with me is this one from 1960. And Lucy is writing. She's on the floor and she goes, "I'm trying to draw," and Charlie Brown's watching her. "I'm trying to draw a political cartoon that will solve all of the world's problems." And she brings the paper up to Charlie's face and she goes, "See, here's Uncle Sam. Here's a dove of peace. And here's an elephant. And here's a donkey. And here's a figure I call the Grim Reaper." And then at this point, she's prattling on, but Charlie Brown is looking at us like, "Are you getting all this?" And she's going, "Over here is a tiny figure I've labeled taxpayer. And down here is a snake saying, 'Don't tread on me.'" And then finally she says, "Don't you think this cartoon will solve all of the world's problems, Charlie Brown?" And he's walking away now, which dawns on me is something that I really associate with Charles Schulz is characters delivering lines as they're leaving. and I just love it because it adds so much force. And he's so to reiterate, she goes, "Don't you think this cartoon will solve all of the world's problems, Charlie Brown?" And he says, "No, I think it will add a few more to it." I think that this one really got me as a kid. And we had a babysitter, Dorothy Alistead, and she was great. And one day I was in her son's room. Her son's name was John, and John was older. He was like a man, you know. He was probably in high school, right? But I thought anybody who could drive was like a man, and he probably was, right? So I was in Johnny's room, and I found all those Peanuts soft cover books. And so I don't know when those came out. Those came out in the 60s, mid-60s, right?
Yeah, they started coming out in the 50s and were huge in the 60s and 70s.
So he had a bunch of them, and I remember just finding them, and I was bored, you know. There was nothing but like a soap opera on TV. This is in the afternoon, you know, after school. Worked, I'd go over to Dorothy's house. And I remember just getting absorbed by this book. It was a Blue Peanuts anthology book. And I remember just getting absorbed by it to the point where I read it from cover to cover in an hour. And I never felt so accomplished because my self-esteem, again, was associated with like, wow, I just read a whole book in an hour. And it was like really great. But within that, I talked to John. John came by and he saw that I was reading it. And he brought up ARG. Like he said, oh, the characters, they go ARG. And he laughed about it. So it was like, here I was now. I was now talking to John on an equal level. Like I had read it and I thought it was funny too. And he like highlighted it. And so it's one of the first times I'm like exchanging ideas, like kind of peer to peer with this guy who's, you know, must have been 17 or 18 at the time.
And how old were you again?
I mean, I'm sure I was like 7 or 8, I guess, probably. And so those two were the ones that really, that I have in memory.
Yeah. Well, I think this February 1st, 1958 one is the most Mystery Science Theater Peanuts strip imaginable. So.
Okay. So they're watching, they're looking at the newspaper. It's Lucy and it's Linus. This sounds like a good movie. I was a teenage warmonger. And then it's just such a funny word, warmonger. And then great choice, perfect. Right? And he's already funny, right? Okay. And so then Lucy's going, oh, how about this one? I was a teenage camel driver. And then she turns to Linus and she goes, which one would you like to see? And Linus says, I don't know. And he finally says, it's difficult to make a decision when you have a choice between two such obviously fine pictures. I like this too because it's to me in some ways he didn't do a lot of this kind of like referring to things like ads in the newspaper or pop culture. It seemed like a lot of my memory of it, it's a lot more pure than that. And and so to have this kind of it seems unique to me, right? It seems
like it's like a topical thing you're not used to
seeing. Yeah, kind of topical and a little bit worldly, but at the same time I'd go, wow, this is like really funny. Like he's really kind of pointing out, you know, the machinery of I was a teenage insert title here, right?
And he's like you point out that like warmonger just being funny, he has a knack of finding those words that are just funny. Like we always point out, they never go to the optometrist, they always go to the ophthalmologist, just because ophthalmologist is a better word, you know. They never listen to Brahms, they listen to Beethoven because it's just a better word.
He is good, so good at that.
And Jimmy's always talking about whenever you put something in quotes, it's funnier.
Oh, yeah. Unnecessary quotes in a comic strip make everything funnier.
I really like that. And to me, the other thing I wanted to say that was kind of on my mind was a lot of how Peanuts happened to me, too, was through all the other things he did, kind of like his merch was really, really special when I was little. And we've talked about this, Harold, like the vinyl figures were so great. And I mean, we had them, we had a couple and I loved them and they were just so special and unique. And there was nothing like them. Like, it wasn't like, hey, we're the vinyl figure makers and we do all the figures that everybody knows about. We've got all the top sellers and we got Peanuts new characters and they're wonderful. They got the Snoopy over there and we got all the characters. They're all lined up and ready to be embossed.
And here's Buzz Sawyer.
We're putting pressure on the creator to have our own character. Which is the adenoidal guy who explains.
I would buy a two-pack of the Adden Oil guy and Buzz Sawyer, actually. And no questions asked. Sight unseen.
So anyway, it's funny, but they were, and I think I've been watching too many of those toy shows. I think I'm doing an aggregate of all the guys, the toys right. that made us, like the guy who ran Kenner, the guy who ran yeah. Kenner. I think I'm doing him. But anyway, so that was a really big thing. And then it was kind of like it blended with pop art so perfectly. Crazy. And so that was the other thing that was happening that was beyond the comic, that was kind of how I started to hear about them and understand them. And of course, the big Christmas special. But when did that come out? What year?
I'm missing 65. You would have been.
Yeah. So it's like from the start, there it is. Yeah. It was kind of amazing. So that was all, those were all the pieces. And then later, I think that's how I started to care about them and want to know more. I had it more served up. Like, I think I was more of on the periphery. Like, I didn't approach him from the comics first. It was these other things. And even, you know, you had to show me an animated cartoon of it before I could get hip and read it, right?
Did it feel different when reading it in strip form than in like the animated form? Did you, or because it seems like his voice is so well preserved.
I think it's in the animation. Beautifully. It translates so beautifully that I kind of can't get over how cleverly they did
now,
that.
Our other host, Michael here, is an OG reader. He was born the year of the strips, so he's never seen the animation because what little snippets disturb him so much that he doesn't want to spoil the purity of the strip.
I get it. But if you're one of those people, man, that saw it, it was this like, it was confoundingly yeah. great. And then for Christians, that he really lays in the actual story, the Jesus story, is kind of wild. And they talk about that in the book, right? Like he...
Yeah, it was awfully... I don't think no on how it reads today, but the fact that he did that in 1965,
yeah, like it was being really, done. Really against trend,
and he kind of earned that. I mean, if you just drop it in, it, you know, yeah. but it was just like, I guess that's my sense. Is 15 years of doing what he was doing, it was so true to Schultz.
Yeah, and he knew that it would carry it, and he kind of understood it and trusted it enough that this is. Legit, but I seem to remember something like with Mendelsohn, right? Was it Mendelsohn who produced
it? Lee Mendelsohn?
Yeah, and it was somehow some moment where he's just rubbing his shoulders going, this will work, man. This is going to be fine.
Well,
don't worry.
I think this. The secret of it is that he has Linus. There's no other cartoon character in 1965 or previously that could talk about something like that. I mean, what are you going to do? Like Woody Woodpecker talk about... But it's absurd, you know?
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And in some ways, it's just going to be hard for anybody to ever catch up to that, no matter whatever sacred text you would like to insert there, or whatever you would want to do. It's hard to get a comic that's going to have that be that profound in that situation. Right. But yeah, it's cuckoo that he did that. I mean, when you think about being a child, you're very powerless, and a lot of the times you're around kids that just don't make sense, you know? And when you finally meet one of those kids that you kind of spark to, right? Like Bright Eyes, you know, hey, you're clever, you know, whatever. And we all have those moments, and it's just so great. We all need them. We all need to find those people, right? And so he kind of was, it seemed like this had, if you needed to talk about it as a confection, it had that so abundantly, that idea that kids are capable of this, and whether they really can talk about it or not, this is what's happening. And it's really true. Like the sincerity of Linus, you'd meet kids like this who were just so pure. They were just sincere, right? And the search for sincerity and the conversation about what is sincerity is amazing, right? For kids, for everybody. Yeah. And that there's these figures that are sincere walking around, like, well, Linus.
And we talk about Linus, his version of sarcasm is to actually just be super sincere. Like if Lucy asks for toast or whatever, he won't say something sarcastic. He will make her the most over the top, fantastic toast just to shame her for asking for the toast. So it's like this super sincerity.
Yeah. It's like the teenage warmonger, right, Jimmy? Where it's like
obviously fine pictures.
How much is sarcastic and how much is it innocent? You don't know.
That's extremely clever. And I think the other idea here that I love so much about Charles Schulz was this feeling like somewhere there's a man sitting in a well-appointed office in a beautiful home, probably overlooking a pool, and drawing Charlie Brown. And that's all he has to do today. And he should be getting done right around supper time. And you just got this feeling like that it felt good that one of us had gotten to that position. One of us had gotten to that thing where they were able to, you know, summon all their powers and do this thing that, whatever it is, right? But it felt really
it was like a dream. It was aspirational.
Yeah, it felt really good. Like I can see I could see him in the office, and I don't know. I have a feeling it was from like Life magazine, right? They do pictorials of him. Remember, there's one where they'd have cutouts of the Peanuts characters around, weren't there? Like around it, like somehow they were in the world, you know, or something, and.
Yeah, yeah. People had seen him at the drawing table.
Yeah, and
that image,
and you kind of got pictures of him and their kids, and you know, and you just kind of go, "What is it like being his kid? It must be electrifying." Yeah. You know, but I think that's part of it too. Is there's such a connection with that individual, that person, because it's one of those few things that just one person can do, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
So that's the other little thing there that's so fun. I don't know.
It's like this singular voice. It's not art by committee. It's one person, one hand, one voice. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for doing this with us, Joel.
Yeah, Joel, this has been a thrill for all of us. We're all just huge fans of you, as you know, and this was wonderful for you to make this time and come on our
show. Oh, of course, thanks. And thank you. Of course, I haven't ever finished thanking Harold. Okay.
Oh, well, go ahead.
I think I did. I think I thoroughly thanked him on this podcast. I feel like really satisfied all of it.
Well, I'm going to go back to yelling at him. If we are all good now, and I think I'm just going to go back to yelling at
him. Harold in the middle.
No, well, and Joel, I'm not done saying thank you for letting me be a part of your creative life. It's been amazing. Oh. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, you guys. Cheers, and good luck with all this. It's lovely.
Yeah, thanks, Joel.
Thanks,
Joel.
All right. Bye-bye.
So that's another episode for us. I hope you guys had as much fun listening to it as we got to have just hanging out with Joel for the day. Special thanks to Joel Hodgson again for coming out and doing the podcast with us. If you want to continue to be a part of this Unpacking Peanuts community, we would love to hear from you. First off, you can always email us through our website. We're unpackingpeanuts.com. And you can also follow us on Instagram and Twitter, where we're at unpackpeanuts. And if you are on social media, if you're just out in the world, anything you can do to help get the word out about this podcast, it would be hugely appreciated. Let's say you know a Mystery Science Theater fan. Why don't you go ahead and hit share on this very episode and see if you could introduce them to our podcast as well. That would be great. Otherwise, on our website, you could buy some t-shirts, you could buy us a mud pie, you could support us on Patreon. All of those things would be much appreciated. So now we're going to go on a little bit of a spring break. I'm working on a secret project. Michael has a project in the works. Harold's on assignment for the head beagle. Liz is sick of listening to us. So we're going to take 2 weeks off, and then we're going to come back with the Sunshine 70s. It's going to be a lot of fun. So until then, for Michael and Harold, this is Jimmy. Be of good cheer.
Yes.
Yes.
Be of good cheer.
Unpacking Peanuts is copyright Jimmy Gownley, Michael Cohen, and Harold Buchholz. Produced and edited by Liz Sumner. Music by Michael Cohen. Additional voiceover by Aziza Shakrala Clark. For more from the show, follow Unpack Peanuts on Instagram and Twitter. For more about Jimmy, Michael, and Harold, visit unpackingpeanuts.com. Have a wonderful day, and thanks for listening.
They got the Snoopy over there.